Start this. Thank you. Our next session is devoted to the new GTLD program, and we will start with a brief presentation of Kurt Pritz. In relation to the major changes which have been introduced in the draft applicant guidebook number 4. If by any chance Kurt needs to leave, Karen will continue the presentation. After the presentation, we will have a chance to interact with the Kurt or Karen, and then we will have a discussion among ourselves. The issues which we may want to discuss, and I was informed that there might be some guest presentations, were on intellectual property issues on intellectual property issues. But that does not mean that we cannot discuss other things. By saying this, I would like now to invite Kurt to take the floor. Ready? And walk us through. Thank you.
Thank you, Yanis, and thank you, everybody. It's nice to see you again. And this is one of the better GAC rooms, much better than the tent and with windows. So I feel very welcome. So this year we have two introductory slides, so there you go. I think before getting into the agenda, the big message around this part of the guidebook that's sort of gratifying is about the ICANN process, public participation, and community consultation. In the past, we're getting close to resolution on the remaining issues in the guidebook, and that's the result of the formation of many community stakeholder working groups, such as the IRT and the STI and the HSTLD and the ZFA and the Vertical Integration Working Group and the IDN Working Group, and I think there's one or two others that convened, and in a very short period of time developed consensus opinions across cross-constituency, across stakeholder bodies where there's generally disagreement. And so in the past 8 months or so, there's really been a tremendous amount of work to arrive at consensus positions around contentious area of the guidebook. And so this version of the guidebook that was just posted has seen updates that are a result of all those consultations. And we Karen and I, have decided to parse the discussion by area of change. So there's a set of changes in the guidebook around malicious conduct, security and stability, around the evaluation process, the criteria for a TLD string, and the application requirements, including how country and territory names are treated, and a number of issues surrounding the registry agreement. And then briefly, I want to talk about the resolution of the so-called overarching issues, but the issues of mitigation of malicious conduct in an environment where there's many top-level domains, providing adequate protection for trademark holders, ongoing economic studies that are bearing some fruit now, and then finally the root zone scaling issue. So with that agenda, so in the areas of malicious conduct, we started out essentially with direction from the community that this be considered more seriously in the guidebook. And starting with a blank sheet of paper, there are now 10 specific areas where there's measures in the guidebook to mitigate potential for malicious conduct. And in this version of the guidebook and in the associated documents, we see these changes. So there's enhanced details around background checks. Background checks were implemented as part of this malicious conduct study. There's a description for a classification of high security TLDs. And in an associated paper, there's a spreadsheet with additional controls for them. There's clarification around registry services reviews and how registry services will be reviewed so that they don't disturb internet stability and security. The Zone File Access Group has developed a model, I think this is an important one, so that all new top-level domains supply zone file data in a standard way, and so that trademark holders or law enforcement can take a single approach to accessing data in cases where they need to perform investigations. So in an environment where there's 16 top-level domains and just a few that trademark holders care about, each one has a very specific way to access the zone file data. In an environment with hundreds of TLDs, that becomes very problematic. And this group that convened developed a standard for providing access to zone file data. So I think that's very important. Also, at the request of different stakeholder groups, a provision is put in the agreement for discussion for who is searchability. That would simplify the investigations of either law enforcement, trademark holders, or others that have a legitimate need to investigate data. And there's an emergency transition procedure for registries that temporarily fail in order to protect registrants. And finally, change of control provisions so that there's ICANN approval required in the case where registry changes hands. So that was all, when we started this, that was all a blank slide. Next, Karen. In evaluation, the changes are less dramatic, but some are important. Pre-delegation testing to test whether the registry in fact can meet its technical promises has been clarified. The evaluation panelists will conform with a code of conduct. That was a request from the community. Our process has added quality controls to ensure standardization across or normalization across test scores or evaluation scores. And finally, there's clarity provided about the role public comment plays in the evaluation process. With regard to TLD criteria, string criteria, country and territory names will not be available in the first round, and that's based on the GAC advice in the recent communiques, which is consonant with the advice we've received from the CCNSO. And we also use the existing definition of country names that was recently posted in accordance with the board resolution on that. To help applicants, we've supplied examples of what a government support letter for a geographic name might be. That's important because it informs the use of that form letter informs the government as to what they're approving exactly, and is intended to promote understanding. Also understanding that you really can't tell a government which letter to use, but it's there for content rather than and substance rather than form. And finally, we've enhanced the IDN table requirements and tried to make them more clear. So I think that's important. There's still contentious issues around the proposed registry agreement, but we think we're close to resolution on those. For those of you reading all this stuff, there's restrictions on co-ownership, so there'll be separation of registries and registrars pending some input from a GNSO group that's working on this issue. So the board as a placeholder has indicated that there should be ongoing separation of registries and registrars, and that resolution has been translated into an implementation that you see in the guidebook that you might refer to as the 2% rule. There's a form of agreements especially for IGOs based on the UPU agreement that has accommodations for, say, treaty organizations, understanding limitations, what they're empowered to agree to, and the restrictions there. So I think that's good. Trademark protections I'll talk some more about later. We've had proposals for trademark protections in a lot of the explanatory memos and other documentation you've seen. This is the first time they're actually in the guidebook, so that's important. The Uniform Rapid Suspension System, the Trademark Clearinghouse, post-delegation disputes of rights after a TLD is delegated. And I can talk more about that after, and it's in the overarching agreement, overarching issue discussion later on. The process for amending the registry agreement has been contentious. So what happens after we sign a few hundred registry agreements and we decide that they should be amended? You know, 500 bilateral negotiations are difficult. So there should be a process for amending the agreement with appropriate, and that process should have appropriate safeguards. There's been a lot of discussion about that, and in the guidebook there's a compromise position that requires approval across a majority of registries and a process for developing amendments. So that's good. And then based on the input of the GAC and CCNSO, what happens if a government withdraws its support of a geographic name after it's been delegated? I'm going to talk more about that in a minute, right? We got more of a slide on that. So let's talk about that exactly. So what's in the guidebook based on what we read in the last GAC communique is that in cases of change of control or registry transition, government approval is required, and also the contract has adopted a GAC recommended clause that says in a dispute between a government and a registry operator, ICANN will comply with the binding decision in the relevant jurisdiction. So that's been included in the registry agreements. And also there's a description how governments in the case of a community-based application may avail themselves of the registry restricted dispute resolution procedure. I can't bring myself to say RRDRP because it's too many letters, but there's a demonstration of how and under what circumstances that can be used. So that was all a reaction to the GAC communique of that came out of Nairobi, I think, right? Okay, terrific. So that's essentially the updates to the changes that were made to the guidebook. I just want to touch briefly on those four issues: mitigating malicious conduct, trademark protections, the root zone scaling, and economic studies. So, as I stated at the top of the show, these are eight of 10 new provisions in the guidebook and elsewhere to mitigate the opportunity for malicious conduct. And I don't think I need to read them all, but I do, because they're really good, aren't they? So, we have background checks, centralized zone data access I talked about. There's a prohibition on wildcarding. There's a method by which registries can act in a way to ensure security in emergency situations, even if they have to temporarily breach their agreement. And so there's an expedited request along those lines. The new agreement requires maintenance of a thick Who Is database to facilitate investigations. The registries are obligated to provide abuse contacts. Orphan glue record removal means that once a name is deleted, all records of it have to be taken out of the zone, so a malicious actor can't use those records in order to use it as a source of spam or other nefarious conduct. And we're now requiring DNSSEC to be deployed in new registries, not just an option for that. So those are improvements. As far as trademarks go, this chart is meant to indicate that trademark protections really cover the gamut of a registry life cycle. Before launch, We have the Trademark Clearinghouse, which is a database for all trademark names. So you put your name in the trademark. That trademark is then, depending on conditions, registries have the option to either use a trademark claims process or a sunrise process. So when I came to ICANN, I knew what a sunrise process was, so I'm not going to talk about that. Trademark claims is in lieu of a sunrise. It would be a notification to a registrant that if they want to register a name in that TLD, they would be notified that somebody has a trademark in that name. So you should tell us, before we're going to register, you should tell us that you have a legitimate interest in that name, and then we'll register it, and you can be on notice. And then once the TLD is launched, there's several other protections several other protections for trademark holders. One is the Uniform Rapid Suspension System, URS, which is a quicker form of UDRP. It results only in name suspension, not in a transfer of names, and it's only intended for clear-cut cases of abuse or trademark abuse. So it's only intended for those clear-cut cases. It's not intended to replace UDRP. It's only meant to complement it. There's a post-delegation process where a trademark holder can actually make a claim against a registry for the actions of registrants abusing names in the TLD. But as you might expect, there's a very high standard there that the registry has to affirmatively act in some way to facilitate that bad behavior on the part of registrants. There's the requirement for THIC Whois, and then UDRP. So those are new, except for UDRP, of course, those are new protections for trademark holders in this process. And so we think that with regard to malicious conduct and trademark protection, that the communities had a really robust discussion about these issues. They made a large, high number of recommendations, and then additional community discussion, not just ICANN staff, but the community really honed those recommendations down to what you see in the guidebook now, the 10 or so recommendations about malicious conduct and these protections for trademark holders. And so, as a tribaloon, we think that's close to done. There's a few slides after this, and so we can post this. But there's more discussion about what the Trademark Clearinghouse is. The next slide is about how the trademark would support a sunrise process or a trademark claims service. And certainly I can ask any question about that. And then a brief discussion of the Uniform Rapid Suspension process. And, I've essentially said all this stuff when I was looking at the chart, because I thought it'd be more fun to look at the chart. And then finally the post-delegation dispute process. And then in addition to these, there's also for community TLDs, we seek to ensure that a community-based TLD that makes promises about how it's going to restrict its operation and its registrations continues to live up to those promises after the TLD is delegated. And so this RRDRP is invented. So those are trademark protections and malicious conduct. With regard to economic studies, the independent economists ICANN recently hired Greg Rostin and Michael Katz, who are working in cooperation with others, recently published their report that's a survey of existing study and a pretty darn good discussion of the costs and benefits associated with new top-level domains. So being new to this environment. A considerable amount of learning went on, and studying, discussion among them, and reading about what's been published from this community, and the result is the paper you see. And so there's still some very important questions to be answered, some empirical analysis about, what are the costs or potential harms associated, a quantification of the harms associated with new top-level domains, and also a quantification of the benefits associated with something. And the way they propose to approach this is take data and then have that, which is part of the second phase of the study, and then have those studies, have that information and data support, have that data support case studies that investigates various business models. So, business models that are designed to compete with .com and other commercial open TLDs, what are the benefits and costs associated with those? What are the benefits associated with TLDs that are designed to broaden the market, which means innovate or provide innovative services, or serve underserved communities, which means IDNs or community-based TLDs? And then what set of rules, either imposed in the past or rules that are proposed here, how would those be effective in reducing cost to trademark holders and others? So I think that the first phase, the initial economic study, is competent and very good and should be read carefully and commented on. And I think the answers to the questions people want most are in the phase two of the study. And we're working with the economists right now to firm up the delivery date for that, which we hope will be in the next very few months. But it's as the price tag to those studies will attest, it's a considerable amount of work, and the time needs to be taken to do that. And then finally, on root scaling, a study was completed in 2009 and submitted to ESSAC and RSAC, who are formulating responses. So it's kind of all I have to say about that. I'm sure as the that causes one to, and me, to ask the question, so what happens if they don't respond or they don't write a report? I think with the imminent launch of the process, they have to respond in some way, either to say stop or go on in some fashion to inform their work. A delegation rate study was completed and posted that projected what the rates of delegation into the top level might be, and predicted that the delegation rate would be 200 to 300 TLDs per year. And that's given the number of applications we expect to receive, which is 500 plus or minus 400, and a period of time to evaluate those applications. Some of them will be simple and straightforward, and so even so, probably take 8 months from application to delegation. Some of them, if they're objected to or require extended evaluation, will take well over a year. So that natural spreading slows the delegation rate. That paper also projects what if we received essentially a million, infinitely many applications, and the process for evaluating them is self-limiting. So is it like 800 or something like that? 800 or 900? Anybody read it and remember it? So it would be like 800 or 900 a year, even if we received an infinite number of applications. More than that wouldn't be forwarded for delegation into the root zone. But of course, even 10,000 is a fantastic number, and we predict that the delegation rates would be actually in the low 200s. So that's a report on the four overarching issues, as well as updates to the guidebook. So I'm happy to answer questions.
Yeah, thank you, Kurt. While members are thinking about their questions, I would like to ask you, what is the timeline now with the discussion of DAG 4 and then final applicant guidebook and then launch of the process? Could you give us some ideas about that? How it is planned currently?
So, thank you, Yanis. If we pretend that this is the last version of the guidebook, and to pretend that, this is ICANN, right? And so it's really the comment that follows this guidebook that's going to dictate that. The ICANN process is sort of like a damped harmonic oscillator where, a material is published and there's quite a bit of public comment, and so the material is iterated and there's a little less public comment and less criticism, and it's iterated again. And over time, that criticism sort of dampens out. And so a judgment will have to be made at the end of the comment period for this guidebook, which is the middle of July, and then the analysis of that follows, whether the amount of change between guidebook 4, which is published now, and the next guidebook is sufficiently small that we think everybody has noticed and all the comments been taken into account. So if we pretend that, then we need to look at what's left to be done. And the major questions have to do with root scaling, I think, and the economic study. And those, I'm not certain about the future of root scaling, but the economic study say that's finished in the fall in the Northern Hemisphere, and you say the September timeframe or something like that. There would be a public comment about the economic study. To help the board make a decision whether the economic study answered the questions asked of it and answered them in a way that justified the justified proceeding with the new TLD process. So that's one of the things left. Another item left to go is the communications plan. So ICANN has had a fairly constant communications plan, a combination of papers, news releases, stories, the work of our regional liaison group, the use of community members in each region to working with the regional liaisons to communicate about this process. So that's been a fairly constant drumbeat. There'll have to be an uptick in that drum to sort of a more intensive communications when the plan draws near, a communications plan that's intended to make appropriate contacts in each region with the goal that the goal of the communications plan, of course, is that at the end of the day, after the application process is launched, someone doesn't raise their hand and say, I didn't know anything about this. So it's a lofty goal and probably impossible, but nonetheless, that's the goal that has to be set. So that more robust communication plan needs to be undertaken. So given those things that are left, the board couldn't consider, approving a final guidebook before the December meeting in Cartagena, but that would be the very earliest and very likely after that, depending on how long the economic study takes to finish.
Thank you. Questions to Kurt? Franz, Bertrand?
Thank you. There are many topics that need to be addressed, but I would like just to focus on two elements. First of all, the economic document that has come out basically 2 days ago is a tremendous departure from any previous economic study that has been produced in the context of this new GTLDs. I must confess that the feeling is, at last, in a nutshell, we had economic studies and a whole GTLD program that was exclusively based on the assumption and the angle of competition. This economic study is at least introducing the notion that this is about social benefits and economic efficiency. And it even introduces a notion that, I mean, in a certain way is completely anathema to anything that we've heard before. It even mentions that theoretically, when there is a huge social benefit in the existence of a TLD, I can should even potentially consider subsidizing the operation of this TLD. I don't mean that it should be done, but the mere fact that it is envisaged and taken into account is a tremendous progress. So I'm really happy as far as I've seen so far. Very happy about the content of this document. The question is, how can this, at this late stage, have an impact and be integrated in the discussion, and how do you feel that this will be the case? The second question is a very little addressed issue that we will probably have the opportunity to come back to later on. Could you give us a little bit of information on how you intend or you consider that the batching could be done once the applications are being received? And I could not ask those questions without mentioning that, again, there's a tremendous work that has been done by your staff on updating the DAG, and we fully recognize the incredible amount of work that it represents. So any criticism or any comment is, as usual, in full recognition of the work that is being done, and I always take great pain of saying it. Thank you.
Bertrand, could you just clarify your second question? Was that how batching of applications would be done during the evaluation process?
Yeah, fundamentally in the DAG, there is a quick portion. I don't have the whole serial number of the paragraph, but the idea is that if there is a certain number of applications that are going to be introduced, like 500 plus or minus 400, as you say, there's a likelihood that the staff will group them by batches. There are several ways to do this. You can either at least do it by contentious sets, because, of course, if some are in a contentious set, you need to put them together. But there are other ways. You can group them by date of application, like first-come, first-served type of thing, or you could group them by similarity and consider that if there are applications that are relatively similar because they address either a common word or a geographic name and so on, they could be grouped together so that maybe the teams that deal with those develop some kind of expertise in one of those types of applications. Do you have any idea already of how this would be handled? Because in the DAG, it's not very detailed, and naturally so.
Right, and that's because on its face, which is sort of seems like a straightforward question, has complexities to it, just like you introduced. So, for example, in the case of contention sets, I think regardless of the method by which they're batched, we have to be certain that those TLDs in contention should be in the same batch in some way. So that would be a rule. So here's the balancing or the decision that needs to be made that's not yet. It seems that given that there may be advantages to being first, that the fairest way is by some sort of lottery, because the grouping, as you describe it, which could be the most a beneficial way of doing it, types of TLD or something, requires some sort of subjective judgment. However, there could also be legal issues associated with, you know, picking TLDs by chance. So I agree with you that grouping them by type or some other combination like that would be the best way. I think at the end of the day, it's going to be sort of a legal. I think the choice of how that's done exactly will be done on a legal basis. What's permitted, what's not, what reduces liability for all parties involved. So, and with regard to your first question, you know, thanks for your comments on the economic study. So I learned some things too. So there's the private benefit to the GTLD owner. That's why he wants a GTLD. And then there's social or external benefit to the community as a whole. And when those two things aren't necessarily in sync, as they are not often in markets, we don't realize the maximum benefit. And so the study, which will be utilized in the long term, suggests that in the long term, I can try to align the costs imposed on GTLD owners, one of which is the ICANN fee, tries to align that with the benefit. So I think maybe adjusting the fees. So I think that's a long-term goal. How ICANN can use this in the short term is that the study identifies, at least on a qualitative basis, the costs associated with starting a new market, such as cost to trademark holders and others, and also identifies benefits, identifies benefits that are, you know, through innovation that's very hard to quantify, right? Benefits for community representation, IDNs. And so how we intend to make use of it, I think, all of us together, is that in the follow-on case studies, the study will attempt to quantify that, the net benefits exceed the net costs, or the net benefits of TLDs are positive, and therefore the TLD program should go forward. It may, there's words in there that indicate that there may be a process to evaluate single TLDs. So if there's a way to evaluate a single TLD and identify that the net benefit of it is negative, or the costs outweigh the benefits, that maybe individual TLDs should be blocked from participating if such an evaluation can be made on a case-by-case basis. That would be built into the new GTLD process.
In the current DAC?
And then, well, in the first launch of GTLDs, yeah.
Okay. So thank you, Kurt. I have now Norway and then Japan. Norway.
Thank you very much, Yannis, and thank you, Kurt, for the presentation. Just a quick comment regarding, you mentioned the post-delegation procedure that was to be put into the registry agreement. Is that in the current proposal for the registry agreement, or do you know exactly which paragraph or where it is actually in the agreement? Because I couldn't find it. But that, of course, you can you don't necessarily have to answer it now. If you don't know, then you can come back to this just for information, I think.
Right. So there's two post-delegation processes, one for rights holders and one for communities. And if you go to the guidebook in Module 5, I'm not going to find it, but if you go in the guidebook to Module 5 and look, the agreement is in Module 5, and then if you look below the agreement, the procedures for both those post-delegation processes are given. There's a clean version and a red line. So, you know, there's a matrix that has the different modules of the guidebook. And look under Module 5, and the two post-delegation processes are there. Does that answer your question?
Well, maybe, but we'll have a look. I just couldn't find it. Of course, it's regarding this with the sort of when a registry operator have a dispute with the governmental approval on non-objection. But we'll check again, and we can come back to you.
Yeah, so maybe I can provide more clarification. So the So there's a lot of actions or I don't know how to put this, though. A lot of acts a government can take with regard to the delegation of a geographical name TLD. So, for example, the government can have an individual agreement, yeah, I'm not telling you anything, but the government can have a side agreement with the TLD regarding its obligation that it can enforce in its own courts of jurisdiction. It could require the TLD to qualify as a community-based top-level domain so that the government can avail itself or others can avail itself of that RRDRP procedure, or, you know, the government can play a role in the policy-making portion of the TLD. I think the governments have options there. And then what the additions that ICANN's made in the guidebook specifically are the clause in the agreement that ICANN will comply with the decision of a court of competent jurisdiction in that area and the other accommodations that have been made. So I think you probably won't find in that process or in that procedure a clause about government participation in it, but the governments may avail themselves of it if a TLD is a community TLD.
Thank you, Kurt. Japan.
Thank you for your presentation and your staff's efforts for elaborating the DAC 4. Japan has a very specific question about the definition of a capital name. DAC 4 defined the capital name separated from the city names in general. And Duffel said the strings of the capital name in any language are considered geographical name. In case of Japanese language, we use three scripts in one language, namely a kanji, hiragana, and katakana. I understand these three scripts for the capital, namely for Tokyo. Tokyo in kanji, Tokyo in hiragana, Tokyo in katakana are considered geographical name, respectively. Is that right understanding? It is a very specific question, but very important for the Japanese language point of view. Thank you.
Yeah, so the answer is yes. Capital city names are identified in official lists, and then the translations of those also qualify as geographic names and are treated as such.
Thank you. May I continue to another question about the geographical name? Regarding the geographical name for a subnational place name, Doug Ford said the string should be exact match of ISO 31662. Under this definition, subnational place names in IDN are not considered geographical name, including the language of that country. In this regard, the definition of the subnational place names, which are considered geographical names, should be more broad and should be clearly described in that form. Thank you. That is a comment for that form.
Can I ask a question? You're talking about protection of names at the second level?
I'm talking about the top level.
Do you comment on?
I should be more clear. I think that I understand that in DAC 4, the subnational place name is considered geographical name by exact match to ISO 61662, but is that applicable for IDN? No, yes or no?
Okay, so that's also my understanding, too. So is your comment that translations of those names should be included?
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Okay, your comment is well noted. Now, Sweden.
Thank you very much. Hello? Thank you very much for the presentation, and I have to admit that I haven't had time to digest all the 312 pages. And but anyway, I have a few issues here, and I will not dig down so deep in the stability and the root scalability, because it's something I did before. Even we still have some concerns around that, of course. But this is about trademark issues, and even though we Sweden think it's became better actually since the last version, there's still a bunch of issues and questions that we think need to be dig down deeper into before moving on. And I have a few examples. For instance, this clearinghouse proposal might be interesting, but how should all the trademark owners know that they need to have their name in the trademark database? And how does a trademark owner know if somebody applies for the name? Does he get some kind of alert, or is it a case that if you have a sunrise period that suddenly all the trademark owners need to protect their names, so they're going to be a flood of applying for the main names, for instance? And what if a company seated in some country actually sues ICANN for registering their trademark for somebody else that applied for just that top level domain? And of course there could be national interest and other conflicts, but basically I think it's very important that the process is clear, so the trademark owners actually knows what the process is and how to deal with them, and it's even good to know that some things aren't solved. So I'm going to write this down and of course send it to you, but this is one of the many I should say questions that we have around trademarks. Thank you.
And we would appreciate getting all those comments and in fact getting a letter that we can answer the questions specifically. So the clearing, you know, just briefly, the clearinghouse is meant to replace the requirement essentially now that each TLD establishes its own clearinghouse. So in the past, when a TLD has been launched, it has a sunrise process, and as part of that sunrise process, it asks trademark holders to register. And so prior to a universal clearinghouse, there'd be a requirement that for trademark holders to register for each TLD. So it's meant to simplify the lives of those trademarks. Certainly, a robust communications plan is very important to notify trademark owners that this is occurring and the opportunity of that. And certainly, you know, there's clearinghouses that exist now, and certainly part of the process of tender to select somebody who can provide this service would be, you know, you're going to get a flood of trademark registrations from very many jurisdictions, all with different you know, confirmation processes to get, you know, to get a trademark in the first place. So it's not simple.
So thank you, Kurt. Germany is next.
Yes, thank you for this presentation. It was quite informative for us. Also, we have to read all these papers, and it's not only the applicant guidebook, but also the explanatory memoranda that are very important and interesting. Concerning the question of the last version, I just want to confirm whether I got the remark correct. There will be a last revised version, I understood, and this would be the last version that is discussed now. And then there will be, after this global public comment period, there will be a last version that is the applicant guidebook, the final version, so to speak. The next question is, we also have to see whether this trademark issues we have to discuss in depth, And also our questions regarding geographical names, I see there is quite a lot of progress, and we have this post-delegation dispute resolution system that is new, and I think also it's a positive progress, but we have to look in these papers in depth. What I also found, I just wanted to know a bit more about the background. In the terms and conditions, it's one of the final pages of our applicant guidebook. I found a clause in that ICANN excludes any possibility of legal recourse for an applicant. If this is real foreseen, it is a very, very strong instrument, because if, for example, an applicant would apply for a GTLD, he receives from ICANN the notion that it's not possible, then he wouldn't have any legal means to challenge this decision of ICANN. For me, it seems to be quite surprising, and I just wanted to know what is the ratio behind of this clause. Thank you.
Thank you, Huber. Kurt?
Yes, so certainly the decision whether this is the last draft version of the guidebook and the next version will be the final one isn't mine. It's the board's, and the board of ICANN, you know, will listen to the comments we receive on this version to determine if we're at a stage where we think the concerns that were raised in the previous versions are addressed. And then you know, certainly to get to your last statement about liability associated with a guidebook or recourse, certainly this undertaking has with it its share of risk. And if you think about, you know, hundreds of applications at, you know, $185,000 US each, and the investment involved in each one, there's significant liability. And so it's a big legal risk that we're trying to moderate for ICANN and still be fair. So, you know, I think comments you have about that would be appreciated. But the approach is certainly to offer some protection in ICANN in this really significant undertaking, which has with it risks. I think, you know, and I'm not a practicing attorney, but you know, you can't protect against all liabilities, right? If ICANN acts improperly, it can always be taken to court. So it's liability in accordance with acting in a certain way with good faith and in accordance with our processes. But if you could put those comments in writing about that term and condition, it'd be very carefully read.
Thank you, Kurt. United States.
Thank you, Yanis, and thank you, Kurt, for taking time again with us today. Just want to share some preliminary comments because, of course, we, like everybody else, are still trying to digest the lengthy V4 guidebook, and we around the GAC table have not yet had a chance to actually discuss with each other and to compare notes, and so, again, these are very preliminary. But I'd like to follow on to what Maria was flagging as some concerns about the trademark issues. And certainly it seems to us that there are some fairly significant improvements in the text compared to DAG V3, but still remain no protections against defensive registrations. And the URS no longer looks as though the R is going to have a lot of meaning, so I'm not sure how rapid it will end up being. And the revisions to the grounds on which the PDDRP, God help us, post-delegation dispute resolution procedure, seems to suggest raise question as to the effectiveness of that particular mechanism. So I did want to just sort of throw those out there. I also wanted to thank you again for taking time on a conference call with the GAC back in April to walk through several questions that we had submitted on the morality and public order. We, again, in the GAC have not had a chance to review how we might want to proceed, but I just think it's worth restating for the record that there is no internationally agreed definition of the terms morality and public order. And in fact, the current usage of those terms in a one single particular treaty is the basis upon which a country may take an exception. So it seems a very odd foundation for something that you will make a positive decision on. So again, we find this internally inconsistent, very challenging, and in fact seriously doubt that you can implement this. Seriously doubt that national governments will find it acceptable that their laws, their regulations, their policies could be overruled or overturned or judged somehow as inconsistent with their ruling. So the concerns that we have flagged consistently remain outstanding, and we may well, as a GAC, come back with some more pointed questions, perhaps, as we continue our discussions. I just thought it was worth flagging it today. Thank you.
Thanks, Suzanne. I might have some responses on defensive registrations and trademark protections. So to borrow the term from the IRT, you know, the trademark protections are supposed to be a tapestry of interlocking protections. And so while there will still be defensive registrations, other protections such as the URS and the PDDRP are meant to provide after the fact, after registration protections for trademark holders. So if there is a rapid part and a cheaper part to the URS that's effective, that might negate the need to defensively register because you can take out a name more cheaply than you could in the past. So they're meant to interact some. So I'm not claiming that there's a remedy or a trademark protection in the guidebook that obviates completely the need for a trademark for defensive registrations, but they are meant to interact in a way where they provide protection. So I watched the URS get more complex as it evolved, and was wishing myself that it was more simple. But when I look at the complexity of it, I think that complexity doesn't come into play. The idea behind I'm gonna repeat back to you what I think you said. But you know, the complexity in the URS is now there's an appeal process now, which it makes it more complicated. And I think there's some other timing things. But when I was sitting in the IRT meetings and this idea was first broached, it's meant to address those really clear-cut cases. And what happens in those clear-cut cases, according to the IP guys that sat in the meeting, is once a claim is made against, in 70% of UDRP cases, a claim is made and the registrant flees. He doesn't protest. He doesn't answer the claim. He gives up the name. there's no case about it. And so all the complexity that's built into the URS and all the things that are going to take the R out of uniform rapid suspension will occur in those cases where the registrant actually puts up a fight. And we think, or the IRT members thought that percent of cases would be almost zero because they're only the clear-cut cases would be approached in that way. So I agree with you that the URS got gummed up, but I think that gumming up really won't come into play in most cases. And then finally on the post-delegation dispute model, there was quite a bit of analysis done inside and outside ICANN about the standards and the grounds upon which you can stake a claim, and especially when you're trying to assert a claim against a registry for the behavior of registrants. You know, think about large or semi-large registries now where we know there's bad behavior occurring. So at what stage do you hold you know, I don't want to say any company names out loud, but at what stage do you hold the large GTLDs responsible? You know, could you hold them responsible for today and take away their TLD for cyber squatting that's occurring with them? Do we think that the TLDs today are that sort of bad behavior? So the advice we got was to craft the grounds upon which you could hold a top-level domain liable for the actions of cyber squatting, say, registrants, needed to be carefully written. So that's the sort of balancing that went on. You know, to take a TLD away can harm other registrants. So that gun needs to be that tool needs to be used carefully. And then, geez, all you said on morality and public order, I've kind of forgotten. I understand it's a complex issue. ICANN's put into the agreement that it will follow the decisions of courts in competent jurisdictions, and follows the rules and rulings of courts from competent jurisdictions. So certainly we would follow that, and then the morality and public order part of it is written, you know, it's written based on the policy recommendation, but also given the reality that the internet's a global place. So how do you make those sorts of decisions in the global environment where laws differ, intersect, and don't intersect and don't overlap? But I will look forward to the comments I receive.
Thank you, Kurt. I have Mark from UK in the line, but also I know that Vipo wanted to speak on the issues of trademarks and protection of intellectual property. But I will ask now Mark, go ahead with your questions or comments, and I will ask Eric, be prepared to take a floor next.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Kurt, for coming to us today to brief us and update us on the DAG 4 and the changes. I agree with what the US has said with regard to some significant improvements on trademark protection. We're certainly glad to see the Clearing House now admit all nationally registered trademarks, as I raised in Nairobi. That was a significant problem for the UK and indeed for the European Union. We do have some remaining questions, specifically on the clearinghouse. We note that it's limited to identical matches, and that's an issue where, as is often the case with rights infringers, they don't exactly match the trademark, but a very close setting out of the name, just a change in a letter or so, or something like that, is intended to, in most cases, infringe the rights of trademark. So that's whether the clearinghouse criteria could extend to near identical matches, I guess, is the question there. In our consultations in the UK, we're also still hearing calls for the globally protected trademarks list, the GPML, to be revisited as in addressing this issue of defensive registrations specifically. There was not a clear exposition of the reasons why this IRT recommendation was not followed up, other than, you know, it might have been difficult to implement and construct, but it's still seen as a very valuable contribution to addressing this issue of defensive, the burden of defensive registrations that major brand owners face. So if there's anything further you can say on GPML, is it totally dead, or can it be revisited in the light of the representations that we in the UK government, and I think the European Trademarks Association, the Marks ECTA, have also raised this point, I understand. We have got other points of to raise to further help refine the trademark protection framework in DAG 4. If I can just make a general point, we will submit the detailed questions separately, and we have got to discuss this within the GAC as well to see if there's shared what we in the UK are saying is shared by other GAC representatives. But a general comment is that the PDDRP, if I've got the right sequence, is an example of where there's a lot of work going on in that sort of post-delegation area, but not perhaps matched. Maybe this touches on your balancing quandary. Not enough is coming through as determined effort to improve the way TLDs are managed to prevent some of these problems manifesting themselves on a wide scale. So there's that sort of general feeling that more could be done at the front end, if you like, if you see what I mean. Just one further point. This goes back to geographical applications. I'm grateful for what you said about the letter, because the letter was a bit of a surprise, and we, the UK, and I'm sure other administrations too, are having to look very carefully at the kind of process they're going to have to set up to consider applications and the issue of whether to object or to give approval. That's going to be important role for governments in this process, and clearly if a detailed sort of exposition of a government position in as that letter template suggested could create problems for us, because it will just open up more opportunities for decisions by us in government to be contested and so on. We will have to obviously have robust and rigorous procedures for dealing with the issue of whether to approve or indicate non-objection or object. But I say I appreciate the explanation you gave, that was a kind of guidance thing, and that is not the expected kind of exposition of a government position that you're expecting to receive in the course of the evaluation processes. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much, Mark. To take your comments in order and address them as well as possible here before we get formal comments, and I just want to say here I look forward to everyone's, and ICANN looks forward to everyone's formal comments, and I just want to make it really clear that I'm responding to questions sort of on the fly here in the best way I can, and responding in writing is more accurate, and so don't take, you know, my representations here are my best try at answering, and the real answers will come in writing. So certainly if you're a TLD applicant, potential applicant, you shouldn't rely on my answers. But so I with regard to the identical requirement of a trademark, we really took that from the IRT. The IRT developed that definition of what's identical, that it's the name or the name separated by hyphens or something nearly identical. So the IRT report originally specified a definition of what identical meant, and the GNSO group, the STI, Special Trademark Interest Group, I think, adopted that. So really we just took that from trademark holders. With regard to the GPML, you know, nothing in ICANN is ever dead or gone. And you know, even if new GTLDs were to be launched without it, it could always be incorporated in it. So with that suggestion, what was written in the comment analysis, a guidebook or so ago, opined that the GPML created sort of a new kind of right. It created a super trademark that had been it's been described in literature in the past, but not with the specificity of creating lists. There have been attempts at it, and I think even WIPO tried to create a GPML list at one time. But in addition to creating a new right for a limited number of entities, which ICANN thought might be difficult, it was also going to be very difficult and expensive to administer for what might be, you know, 100 beneficiaries or 200 beneficiaries or 50, you know, depending on which IRT member you spoke to. A relatively small number. So there's a paragraph that we could find in the comment summaries that describe the reasoning for not having it. But of course there are still comments in support of it, and the board listens to all comments carefully. And with respect to post delegation disputes, I agree too that the prevention is the key. And the trademark objection is supposed to be a preventative measure, among others. But comments you have or suggestions you have about moving the disputes up in front of delegation rather than behind them, would be more inexpensive and efficient for all parties. And then finally, with the letter, what ICANN was trying to do with that letter was provide applicants or some sort of tool so that governments knew what they were approving, that the approval of a TLD, a geographic name TLD, was not taken lightly. So the letter can be used or not used, and it can be taken out of the ICANN literature. Certainly, especially in this area, we'd follow the lead of the opinion of this advisory committee and its members as to whether that's helpful or not. We're trying to protect the interests of governments through that letter. So if you think it's less helpful or it would be more helpful to have it omitted, we'd take that advice.
So thank you, Kurt, for the presentation. Presentation has been sent to the GAC list. Please check your mailbox. We now will move on to intervention of Eric Wilbers, Director of WIPO Arbitration and Mediation Center, who will speak a little bit about WIPO's reading of DAG 4 when it comes to IP protection and trademarks. You're most welcome to stay on, though I know you have a board workshop on the same subject. So,
thank you very much, Giannis, and thank you very much, everybody, for your attention and time.
Yeah, thank you. And now, Eric, floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While Kurt is still here, let me second what Bertrand has expressed as respect for the tenacity and energy that goes into this persistent effort. I would like to add to that obviously it is an extremely difficult challenge that you and your staff are facing. I represent the WIPO Arbitration Mediation Center, as the chair has just mentioned. WIPO itself, 184 member states, has contributed, among other things, to UDRP to ICANN and also maintains UDRP pretty much on a non-profit basis. We are an observer of the GAC. Now, I'm grateful for this opportunity to briefly speak. Intellectual property, of course, is but one of several considerations that have to go into the design of the DNS. That is true for the DNS today, and it is true for the future of the DNS, and we are aware of that. However, it's clear that it's a hugely important element into the design and the future of the DNS. We have to realize that probably the majority of registrations today are based either on the use of a trademark or the abuse of the trademark. And that, of course, translates into income for registration authorities as well. on the one hand, and to some extent opportunities, and to another extent damages for trademark owners. So it is one element of the DNS, but it's an important one. We must also realize, of course, that the IP rights that we are talking about that represent these opportunities both for IP owners and for IP infringers emanate from the legal systems represented by the GAC members sitting here today. And that brings me to the question of the relationship between DAC4 and intellectual property. And here, while Kurt is happily still here, I'd like to take issue briefly with the claim that DAC4 represents the input of the intellectual property community to a degree of satisfaction that now warrants a statement that this is pretty much or should be pretty much a done deal. To the contrary, we at the WIPO Center see on some key choices mostly pressures from registration interest reflected. And without taking too much more of your time, I'd like to illustrate that by a very specific reference to a few core positions and observations on some of the dispute resolution mechanisms that are now at the table. And I'll do so by just citing briefly from the letter which WIPO has sent in on June 16, and which you will find on WIPO's website, giving a summary input on this. And the first one is this famously acronymed PDDRP. I'm getting it right the first time around. And the title of those observations is that ICANN's current PDDRP misses a timely opportunity for registration authorities to responsibly partner towards a credible DNS. The WIPO Center has consistently encouraged a forward-looking approach to stimulate discussions, including, importantly, on safe harbors. Currently, our feeling is that registration interest appears somewhat reticent to this approach. The scope of the current ICANN PDDRP, as limited to affirmative conduct on the part of registries, undermines the intended effect of encouraging responsible TLD management and DNS credibility. With the WIPO Center, significant ICANN stakeholders, including, among others, INTA and Marx and ECTA, have called for consideration factors to address the very real possibility of willful blindness occurring in the course of the management of new domains. At a time when prospective applicants are seeking clearance of practically unlimited registration opportunities, it is unconstructive for those interests to expect trademark owners to perpetually turn to second-level enforcement efforts in a multi-jurisdictional context. A proactive approach would be to focus on the design of realistic safe harbors, which would not include a sweeping policing duty for registration authorities. ICANN's emerging contractual framework for registries, registrars, and registrants offers a unique opportunity for all bona fide stakeholders to combine a measure of legal certainty with a move away from questions of liability to responsible partnership for a new DNS. The second and shorter point comments on the URS, where our title is the current URS has become an overburdened procedure. The WIPO Center believes in the potential for a lighter alternative to DDRP and has in fact made a proposal to this effect over a year ago. However, the uniform rapid suspension system is emerging from committee work as an unduly burdened option for obtaining the temporary suspension of a domain name. That burden currently consists of a combination of factors, including panel appointment even in default cases, panel examination of possible defenses in default cases, the possibility of appeal during 2 years from default, a higher burden of proof, uncertainty as to results, i.e. owing to possible gaming scenarios and revolving door monitoring burdens, the use of the conjunctive bad faith registration and use, limiting marks forming the basis for a U.S. claim to either so-called substantive review or clearinghouse validated marks, with time and cost implications, apparent translation requirements, a seeming option for refiling, the possibility for de novo appeals, and significant timelines. I'm almost to the end of this letter. The third element of the rights protection mechanisms we address here is the clearinghouse. The current design would appear to turn the clearinghouse into an arbiter of the validity of trademarks legitimately obtained through systems applied in many jurisdictions. In the effort to counter the possible gaming of trademark systems for the DNS, it is important that the clearinghouse functions on a non-discriminatory basis. The possibility could be explored of treating registered marks as prima facie valid, e.g. were subject to later challenge. Furthermore, limiting the use of clearinghouse data to identical matches and only at launch would miss many abusive domain name registrations. The clearinghouse operating term should not unduly capitalize on trademark owners' infringement concerns. And the final point in this letter, seizing this opportunity, is ICANN's new DTLD program should not be a catalyst for destabilizing the proven UDRP. The current new DTLD program represents an opportunity to design RPMs that meaningfully complement the UDRP. It should not open the door to ill-advised efforts that will risk destabilizing the globally recognized UDRP tool. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Eric. Kurt, do you want to somehow react? Or?
Sure.
Hi, Eric.
How you doing? Good to see you. So, it is good to see you again. Eric and I have worked, we had discussions about the creation of what morphed into the PDDRP probably well over a year ago now, as we discussed ways of protecting trademark owners in this new environment. And so where our the ICANN position is different from what's in the guidebook is different from what Eric said, is the notion of a standard that's willful blindness versus affirmative conduct. And so if I read your letter the right way, and I'm not, and we haven't talked about it at ICANN at all yet, so I just read it, there's protections in a willful blindness standard plus safe harbors that might provide some protection for registry operators. And if you were here earlier, I voiced the concern in fashioning a standard for PDDRP is that a willful blindness standard without safe harbors might sweep before it many of the existing registries now, because each registry is aware that some cyber squatting occurs in their TLDs, or in many of them, and so we wanted to fashion a standard that at least at the outset was very careful that bona fide socially responsible registries weren't adversely affected by a standard that might sweep before them. So that was the concern in putting forth a standard that included willful blindness in the current version of the post-delegation dispute resolution model. And I also made some comments earlier about the URS has been complexified, but we think those complexities all happen actually after all the real action will happen when the IRT developed the idea of a URS. It was because 70% of UDRP cases are really not contested, and the registrant walks away and seeks to target some proportion of those. And so the existence of an appeal, or the fact that a name can be re-registered didn't enter into their discussion, because an appeal will never come into a play with a registrant that just walks away. With regard to the revolving door, I think the STI tried to address that when they said that the name would be suspended for the term of the registration, plus it could be suspended for another year after that. And then finally, with the URS, I understand how appointing a panel and going through a review, even in cases of a default, adds time to it. But that was a requirement really requested by the IRT. So we were responding to their model that said there should be a review, a substantive hearing, even if not a hearing, but a review of the case, even in cases where there's a default. So I understand. Yeah, I agree with you that I watch the URS get more and more complicated over time. But I think those complexities really don't enter into cases where the registrant just walks away. And then, the more you talk about it, the more complicated it gets. That with respect to the clearinghouse, the clearinghouse is obligated to have allow every registered trademark from every jurisdiction be in the clearinghouse, and then the question is, when is a registry obligated to honor that trademark in its sunrise or TM claims process, and that's been broadened in this guidebook based on comment from WIPO and others to include more trademarks, essentially all of them, in the trademark claims process and validated trademarks in the sunrise process. So there were changes in the fourth version of the guidebook to attempt to address the issues you raised there, but because we can't have the full discussion here, we read the letter as soon as we received it, and it's going to be the cause of much discussion going on from here, not just this overly terse answer that I'm trying to give in front of all these people.
So thank you, Kurt. You're right. In my part of the world, in Latvia, we're saying deeper you're in the forest, more trees you see. So more you think about it, more complex it becomes. So that's clear. We will now make a little break, maybe 3 to 5 minutes, to convene a meeting with the GNSO after this small break. We will continue discussing DAG4 in our meeting on Tuesday and also on Wednesday. And certainly we will address the issues related to DAG4 with the GNSO. So this meeting stands adjourned, and we will resume in 5 minutes.